Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Tim Hing, and we'll be answering your most important questions on Colorado's Roaring Fork River. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Tim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Tim about Colorado's Roaring Fork River. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their clean angling pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Tim, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Tim's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a dozen of the Roaring Fork's hottest flies, courtesy of Taylor Creek Fly Shop. And Taylor Creek Fly Shop is at taylorcreek.com on the Internet, so you can find out more about them there. And that's also the shop that Tim works out of. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, and the question will be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win the dozen hot flies for the Roaring Fork. Tonight our guest is Tim Hing. Tim is a Colorado native and has been involved in the fly fishing industry in the Roaring Fork Valley for more than 30 years. Tim established the first fly fishing shop in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, and helped pioneer drift boat fly fishing on the Roaring Fork River in the early 1980s. Tim joined Taylor Creek Fly Shop in 1990, the oldest fly shop in the Roaring Fork Valley, with the most experienced guide staff. He has also sponsored many fly fishing trips to Christmas Island, Ascension Bay, Mexico, Patagonia, Argentina, Venezuela, and Andros Island in the Bahamas. Tim enjoys tying flies and is a contract fly designer and the creator of the Autumn Splendor and BLM, that's Beaded Little Mayfly. The BLM was awarded the Fly of the Year in 2002 by Fly Fisherman Magazine. Tim has appeared on ESPN, ESPN2, and continues to write and speak at many of the fly fishing shows. Well, Tim, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger.
Well, good to have you back on board here.
Last time
we talked about the Frying Pan River, and which is in your neck of the woods, too, and actually feeds into the Roaring Fork. So that was a fun interview, and so we might as well finish up the valley there, or kind of. There's a lot of other places to fish around there, too.
That's right.
Yeah. So, let's dig in. I guess tonight what we'll try to do is give a little background about the area and then talk about specifics about the river, food, flies, that kind of thing, and then do a little tour down river so you can, because the Roaring Fork changes its character as it moves down the valley, and hopefully we can give people a description and helpful hints on how to fish each section. So that's our plan.
Sounds great.
Okay. So where is, for, you know, we do have an international audience, and not everybody knows where some of the places we talk about are. So where is the Roaring Fork on the globe, and how do you get there if you want to go fishing there?
Well, it's on the western slope of Colorado. It begins up on Independence Pass, which is near Aspen, Colorado, and finishes, enters into the Colorado River in Glenwood Springs. Glenwood Springs is about 160 miles west of Denver, so probably that's one of the most common ways to get there is to take, whether you fly into Denver or drive into Denver and drive over from there.
Okay. Oh, there is that kind of fun flight into Aspen, too, though, isn't there?
Well, there certainly is. It certainly is. Aspen, and it is kind of a fun flight into Aspen, no question about it. And a lot of our folks, you know, from around this area do fly in here that have homes here and things like that. But, but you know, most of the folks will drive in or so.
Yeah, I just remember flying in there. I did a job up in Aspen once and flew in there, and the approach was very exciting. And folks,
right.
It's like a narrow valley, short runway, and they get down and in there fast, and it was fun. But could be hairy too, I imagine, at times. Well, yeah. So how long is the river from start to from the headwaters on down to?
Actually, from the headwaters up on Independence Pass down to where it enters the Colorado River is almost 60 miles in length.
Oh, 60. Wow.
Uh-huh. So it's been said that it falls more in elevation in those 60 miles than the Mississippi does in its entire length. I'm not sure that's exactly true, but it wouldn't surprise me because, you know, it starts high on Independence Pass, which is a little over 12,000 feet in elevation, and by the time it enters Glenwood Springs, it's a little over 5,000 feet in elevation.
Mm-hmm. And the Indians used to call it by a different name, right?
They did. It was called the Thunder River by
yeah.
the Indians. So,
but between Thunder River and Roaring Fork, you kind of get the idea, right?
That's right. Well, if you think, you know, that it drops, you know, almost 7,000 feet in elevation in those 60 miles.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of water moving through there rather fast. Yeah. We had a question from Dan in North Dakota. He says, I fish in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming regularly. Given great waters in these states and others, why would I consider fly fishing the Roaring Fork?
Well, I think probably the diversity of the Roaring Fork is what makes it so neat. Not to mention the fact that it has other many great tributaries like the Frying Pan that enter into it that you could also fish. But in that 60 miles of river, you know, we have some, you know, high little streams to areas where it falls, you know, fairly rapidly, to areas where it flattens out as it gets down closer to Glenwood Springs, where a lot of us use drift boats and things like that in the lower parts of it, but in the upper parts of it, you know, the only way to fish it is to wade it. So you really have a lot of diversity, both in the size of the fish, the numbers of the fish, and the ways we fish it.
Yeah, you could probably spend a whole summer there on that one stretch of river and have about every experience you'd want fly fishing, I would think.
You could, and you know it, and you kind of just chase the hatches around as well, because what may start in Glenwood Springs at a certain time of the year may not get up toward Aspen until, you know, maybe a month or more later.
Right, right. Now, are there certain seasons that are better than others for the Roaring Fork, or is it a all-year-round fishery?
It's actually a tremendous all-year-round fishery. Certain parts of it are not so much. The upper parts of it certainly get, you know, a lot of snow and ice, and we don't fish the upper reaches of it in the winter time. But from Basalt down, where the Frying Pan enters into it, you know, in its lower 25 miles or so, we fish it all winter long. So there's not really, I mean, there's certainly great seasons of it, of different things happening at different times, but there's not a time of the year that it's difficult to say which is my favorite.
Yeah, yeah. But the and it's not a it's a free running Freestone River, right? I mean, there's no it's not a tailwater or anything. Which
that's right.
Frying
no dam
is, but
that's right. No dams on it at all, and I'm sure there probably never will be.
Yeah, yeah. Which is I'm sure there will be. That people in Aspen would probably have a tizzy over if you flooded their town, right?
Yeah, they probably.
That'd be an expensive dam.
It would probably be yes.
I remember the fight around where I lived, what was it called, the Twin Forks Dam that they tried to put in, and that was a big, big fiasco, and thank goodness they didn't put that in, but that's kind of in my backyard. Anyway, since it is free, you know, a free-running stream with no dam control, you're kind of at the whimsy of nature as far as the water flows, right? And is it, can you kind of tell us about the water flows? Is there certain times of the year that you can't float the lower section, or is it always floatable? Is there always enough water?
Well, there's, you know, we really always have enough water. I mean, we've actually had some difficult times last year with, you know, the low snowpack in Colorado, all over Colorado, that, you know, pretty much made our streams all be very low and all of our reservoirs very low as well. But we were still able to, throughout the year last year, float it. So I have not ever seen it to where it's not, where you couldn't float it. I mean, even at the very low levels, we can float it in rafts or something like that. If
right.
you can't take a drift boat down it, but we can always float it. Really, the only time we don't float the Roaring Fork River is during the spring runoff, and that can be, oh, it's generally speaking, it's around end of May toward the middle of June, middle of May to the middle of June that we might not in a normal year be able to float it. But other than that, we pretty much float it year-round.
I got a question here on the Internet I'll have to throw in here right away, and you might know this person. But Molly in Basalt, Colorado wants to know, will this show be over in time for me to get out and hit the drakes tonight?
Well, it will be, actually. You know, I think we get over about 8:30, and I was on the river last night, and that's just about the time when those drakes started popping off. So, Molly, you should be able to get out there and enjoy those tonight.
Well, they're right in her backyard there. My gosh, you know.
That's right.
Closer. So, anyway, that's kind of funny. So, what species of fish are available in the Roaring Fork?
We mostly have brown trout, rainbow trout, and Rocky Mountain whitefish.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, with probably a little bit more brown trout than rainbow trout, maybe a 65-35 type of ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And the whitefish certainly more prevalent in the lower parts of the river than it is in the upper parts of the river, than they are.
I read somewhere that there's some pretty monster whitefish in there, right?
There's some pretty big whitefish. But you know what? It seems like we don't have quite as many whitefish as we did 20 years ago or so, before whirling disease. And I'm not sure if... I've read some studies in other places of Montana and things like that that they've said that the whitefish are actually affected by the whirling disease to some degree as well. I'm not sure what that effect is, but we don't catch them quite as often as we did, like I said, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. I never really had too much of a problem catching whitefish because usually those went in the cooler. I take them back and smoked them because they're really good smoked, you know, and let the trout go. I know in some rivers they ask you to take the whitefish out, you know. But
right.
And they can be a pretty darn good fight, too, so, I don't, you know. Yeah,
well, that's really, for most folks, and myself included, the only time, you know, you may not like catching a whitefish is when you see that it's actually a whitefish you've caught, because when it's out on the end of the line
mm-hmm.
and it's fighting out there, it's just as good as any other fish that there is. So
yeah, yeah.
It's just when you bring it in and see it.
Yeah, yeah. You thought you had a 3-pound brown on, and it's a 3-pound whitefish. Yeah, yeah, I hear what you're saying. And there's probably some brook trout way up in the headwaters, I assume, too, right?
There is. There's some brook trout. There's a few cutthroat trout up in the, you know, in the headwaters between Independence Pass and Aspen.
Mm-hmm.
But once it gets below that, they don't seem to compete. You know, those native fish don't seem to compete as well. So.
Yeah. What about, does the river hold any trophy fish?
Well, I mean, there's some awfully nice fish. I mean, certainly, and again, the larger fish are in the larger water as you get closer to Glenwood Springs before it falls into the Colorado. But I don't know. I think the biggest fish that I've ever heard of perhaps being caught out of it is, you know, like the 12, 13-pound browns, you know, things like that. I know some of the old-timers talk about fish even larger than that, but that's as big as I've heard of.
Yeah, yeah. So there are some big ones in there, yeah. And is there any fish come up the river from Colorado? Is there any kind of a spawning?
Oh, sure, a spawning run? Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah?
Sure. Yeah, we see, you know, we see rainbows in the spring and browns in the fall running up out of the Colorado. And actually, we see them at different times of the year, too. In a year when we see the Colorado River be very, very low and running warm, we sometimes will see some of the trout from the Colorado run up into the Roaring Fork because it's a cooler river. The water temperature in it is cooler.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, I can imagine that. Because the Colorado is getting big and wide there and warming up, that's for sure. Mm. We've got Bruce from Alexandria, Virginia, wrote in and asks, what's the best source of information for legal access points for wade fishing on the Roaring Fork? And what are the Colorado stream access laws?
Well, there's a terrific map put out by a gentleman here in the valley called by the name of Mike Shook, and he puts out a map that shows all of the public access on the two major rivers we have in the area, which is the Roaring Fork and the Frying Pan. And that's available at any of the local fly shops around. I think the price of the map is $10.95, but it's available to any of those. And it really is a very comprehensive map that Mike has done a lot of work on and really done a very nice job. The Colorado access laws are certainly different than Montana or maybe a lot of other states. The landowner in Colorado owns the bottom of the river, so you cannot wade up the river if you access it by legal means in other areas. You can't step property or can't step foot on his property, you know, if you're wading. You can, in the lower part of the Roaring Fork River, you know, you can float through it. That's not a problem as long as you're not dropping anchors, but you can't wade up through there.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Which is different than like Montana's laws, which basically, I know up on the Bighorn, you can wade and fish any part of the river, but you can't go above waterline in some areas. And that
mm-hmm.
becomes private property, so it's
right.
It's a good question to ask if you're coming from out of state. Cause,
oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You need to be aware of the laws, the local laws, wherever you're fishing. So.
Right, right. Well, we are at the point where we need to take a quick break here, Tim. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the Roaring Fork. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com and view the fishing products and guide services they offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. Learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters at www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tim Heng about Colorado's Roaring Fork River. If you'd like to ask Tim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Tim, I always ask my guests at this point in the show, what's going on in your fly fishing world? So tell me what's happening in the Roaring Fork Valley and with you specifically.
Well, right now, is that what you mean, Roger?
Well, not right this second. But.
Oh, okay.
Well, we might not want to know that.
Like I said, the Green Drakes are going on right now. So.
Oh, well, yeah, that's important. Yeah, they are. And this is the time of the year, right? Yeah, beginning of
yeah, this
July.
Is the time of the year. We start to see the drakes hatching on the lower Roaring Fork in about the last week of June, generally, and they gradually move their way upstream, and we see them in the middle of July, on the upper parts of the river. So it's an exciting time. The green, when they're hatching out there, it's a very large bug. We're using size 10 and 12 dry flies, and it's a great time of the year.
Yeah, and they move up the frying pan too, don't they?
They do, and they generally start on the frying pan around the first of August, first to second week of August, and they work their way up the frying pan for another couple of months. And so we have them around. We're pretty fortunate. We have them around for several months every year.
Yeah, pretty cool. And tell us about the shop you work out of and what their website address is and stuff like that.
I work out of Taylor Creek Fly Shop. It's located right on the banks of the Frying Pan River in Basalt, which is about, from Glenwood Springs, is about 25 miles, about 15 to 18 miles from Aspen. So it's right at the confluence. The shop sits about 100 yards away from the confluence between the Frying Pan and the Roaring Fork River. So on our website, our telephone number is 970-927-4374. Our website is taylorcreek.com. You should check it out. And get on our Facebook page and...
follow the drakes, huh?
Yeah, follow the drakes, exactly.
Yeah, those are exciting bugs, I know. They're big, big monsters, that's for sure, which makes things it's a lot more easy to work with than those, you know, size 24 midges, you know, that we normally
do. That's right, but it's all fun. I mean, you know, we enjoy those little midges, you know, as well. So
yeah.
It's just a little bit different tactics and different bugs for sure. So it's all quite fun.
Well, in the on the Roaring Fork, what would you suggest as far as rods, and would the rods be different as, you know, downstream as far as upstream in the way of length and weight and so forth?
Yeah, they certainly would, Roger. I mean, just simply because the river changes so much in that 60 miles of what we have, you know, and you know the flows, you know, it's just a much smaller river in its upper reaches. And we certainly fish the high country around above Aspen, from Aspen to Independence Pass, for some of the small fish that are up in there. And those situations, you know, we're fishing little tiny rods. You know, we're maybe fishing two weights or three weights, something like that, and 7-foot lengths. And, you know, a large fish up there is probably going to be 8 to 10 inches, with most of the fish running more 6 to 8 inches. As we move on downstream, you know, I like fishing lighter rod in the upper, from Aspen toward Basalt, in the 4 weight range, 8.5 to 9 feet. And then by the time we get down to Glenwood Springs, probably a 6 weight is going to be a, you know, 9'5" or 6 weight is probably going to be the best rod size,
right,
length.
Okay. And what about leader and tippet setup out there? Is it mainly, first of all, are you mainly working with floating lines on the river?
Almost totally. I mean, we'll throw streamers in the fall, certainly. We might use some short sink tips and things like that, but almost everything is floating lines.
And how sensitive are the fish in the river to, you know, tippet size?
Again, it really depends on the time of the year. I mean, we'll fish, you know, throughout the river, you know, we've got these big green drakes, you know, we may be using 3 and 4X tippets to fish those guys, and but yet we'll have little blue wing olives in sizes 20s and 22s in the spring and the fall. We'll, you know, we have to go down to 6X, rarely 7X that we go down to on the Roaring Fork, but oftentimes we'll go down to 6X and lengthen our leaders a little bit and fish those little tiny bugs, you know, with that kind of a setup.
Right. What are some of the major, other than green drakes, which obviously, and that's probably one of the favorite hatches, I would assume, on the river, but what are the major food sources on the river or in the river?
You know, the Roaring Fork is, you know, it has really nice mayfly hatches of those green drakes. We've got great PMD, pale morning dun hatches. We see great blue wing olive hatches in the spring and in the fall, and even during the summer, you know, when the other hatches have started to dissipate a little bit, we'll turn around and concentrate more on the blue wing olive type things. But predominantly, it's a caddis river. There's just a lot of caddis in the river. And I think that's the major food source for those fish throughout the year, I think.
Mm-hmm. Is that the tan caddis variety rather than black caddis?
Yeah, certainly more of them are tan. You know, I've really never tried to identify them all or anything like that, but we have so many different sizes and types of caddis, you know, from our Mother's Day caddis that happens around the end of April every year to you know, just to our little tiny micro caddis to big, you know, fall caddis and just all different types of caddis.
Yeah, yeah. Cool.
And probably more underwater than it is, you know, on the surface that we fish them. I mean, I think most trout eat probably 95% of their food or more underwater anyway.
Right, right. Do you get any really those intense hatches like you see down on the Arkansas?
Yeah, we get that same Mother's Day caddis hatch that you see on the Arkansas.
Yeah.
The same time. Maybe a little bit earlier here than it is on the Arkansas. You know, they call it the Mother's Day hatch, and I think that's probably, you know, they call that all over the West, kind of. But I think that, for us anyway, that it's almost over it's starting to slow anyway by the time Mother's Day comes around. It's usually a week or two earlier than that when it starts.
Yeah, some people call it the tax day hatch.
Yeah. That's right. We're kind of in between there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Mark in Thornton, Colorado, wrote in, and he said, if you can only take two flies on a float trip from Carbondale to Glenwood this weekend, what would they be?
Oh. Mark, don't make me take just two flies. I can't. I don't know if I could do it. Well, certainly one of them would be a green drake. One of them would probably be a green drake, and the other would probably for me have to be a prince nymph, just because it's kind of a prince nymph type river. It seems like you can always catch fish on the Roaring Fork on a prince nymph.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, that's always been a good fly. Yeah, I mean, on about every river, but yeah. And then Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas, he's giving you a little bit more leeway. He wants you to share your top flies for the river, and would they change throughout the season?
Oh, sure. Definitely have to change throughout the season. You know, the top flies that we're fishing now are on the surface are caddis and green drakes and tail morning duns, and underneath the surface are the nymphs of those bugs, you know, and that at this time of the year. But you know, our major mayfly hatches, at least as far as our bigger bugs go, our green drakes on the and our pale morning duns seem to be best from probably the end of June until the beginning of August or so. Mm-hmm. And then those hatches start to slow down a little bit. And as I said, then we start to move into the blue-wing olives a little bit more. And those blue-wing olives and blue-wing olive types, I'm not just talking about just strictly blue-wing olives. I'm saying I kind of categorize all small little grayish olive-bodied mayflies, you know, that are ranging in 18s to 22s kind of together. And we'll fish those all the way up until November or so. Mm-hmm. And then again in the spring from March on into where the runoff starts in the middle of May.
Yeah, those are always kind of cooler weather hatches.
Mm-hmm.
I always remember fishing those when the snowflakes are falling out. So.
That's right, or when it's raining, or that certainly is best then.
Yeah. Yeah, I was looking at a hatch chart here for the Roaring Fork, and it looks like those caddis are active from, according to this one, April till the beginning of October. So they're all summer long, huh?
Yep, they certainly are.
Yeah, good hatch. A couple other questions Mark had is, are there any streams or lakes that you would suggest next nearby?
Well, we talked about
frying pan, right?
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit. The frying pan, you know, is a pretty world-famous type of a tailwater fishery in itself. It's 14 miles between Rudai Reservoir and where it enters into the Roaring Fork, and it certainly is a terrific fishery. The Crystal River is another tributary to the Roaring Fork, and that comes out of the Crystal River Valley around the town of Carbondale, and that's a nice little fishery. It doesn't hold quite the numbers of fish or quite the extensive bug life that the Roaring Fork and the Frying Pan hold, but generally speaking has less folks on it. And there's numerous small creeks that enter into it as well. You know, there would be Maroon Creek up near Aspen or any number of small creeks that enter into it too. And the same says for our lakes, you know. It's a pretty extensive valley, so we have a lot of high country lakes that people enjoy hiking to. A lot of them that you have to hike to fish them, and some of them that you can drive to and fish as well. It's a almost too many to mention any of them in particular because there's just so many of them. So I'd say.
Right.
Again, you know, if you like to come out of here and fish our local waters and you wanted to fish some of these high country lakes or streams, is just get in contact with either the shop here or one of the other local fly shops or something like that, and we'd be happy to tell you where those places are.
Yeah. What about on the, and maybe you can talk more as we take our little river tour down here in a minute, but there was one question about whether the dry dropper combinations work well on the Roaring Fork. And I think we'd be talking, you know, more lower section probably.
I don't know. I think dry droppers, other than in the headwaters of the streams, you know, where the, you know, the water's pretty small and the fish will seem to come up to take an adult insect pretty much
yeah.
Anytime. They're opportunistic feeders rather than selective feeders. Anywhere pretty much from Aspen down to Glenwood Springs, which 40-some miles of river, I'll fish a dry dropper an awful lot.
Yeah. What kind of combinations do you use?
Oh, gosh, it could be caddis with caddis droppers, drakes with drake nymph droppers. I mean, usually it's a combination of a specific insect and its underwater stage, you know, whether at that time of the year, whatever time of the year those bugs may be hatching.
Right. What about streamers on the Roaring Fork? You had mentioned that a little bit earlier, but is there a particular time of year that's best for those? And
it's really good streamer fishing when the river first starts to clear after runoff, and that's, again, usually middle of June to, you know, the first couple of weeks of July. And it's really good in the fall when the browns start to get actively spawning. So they, you know, they become aggressive at that time of the year, and so we fish a lot of streamers then.
Where do the browns go in the fall? Do they just kind of go upriver and looking for spawning grounds, or do they go head up the Frying Pan or the Crystal?
I think a little bit of all of that. You know, there's a lot of brown trout that will spawn in the river itself, you know, and I mean, they say that with a lot of spawning fish, you know, there may be some of them that travel 20 feet to find a suitable habitat for spawning, and there's some that may travel 20 miles to find what they are looking for in that suitable habitat. So, being more of a brown trout fishery than a rainbow trout fishery, we fish those streamers a lot more often at that time of the year.
Yeah. So it really doesn't change where you fish so much in the river. How you fish it. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking
the lower parts of it.
You know.
Yeah, the bigger parts of the river, the lower parts of the river, we fish them more than we would in the reaches right below Aspen or something like that. But at times we'll fish them up there as well.
Yeah. Good. Well, let's take another quick break, and then let's start our tour down the river so you can give us a picture of what the river's like.
Sure.
So we'll be right back. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tim Heng about Colorado's Roaring Fork River. If you'd like to ask Tim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Tim, let's take a trip down the river, starting up at the headwaters, because I guess there's could really talk about the headwaters to Aspen as being the high country part of the river, correct?
Yep, very definitely so. And very definitely so. Those headwaters, which is about it's about 17 miles from Independence Pass down toward Aspen, where the river starts up at Independence Pass, and it falls a lot in those headwaters. It falls from, again, a little over 12,000 feet up there at the head of it to down to Aspen, which is about 8,200 feet in elevation. So it falls about 4,000 feet in elevation in that. That 17 miles or so. So, mostly small fish. Again, as we talked about just a little bit earlier,
a lot of pocket water and
a lot of pocket water. There's some small tributaries up there as well, and Lincoln Creek and things like that that you can also fish. Most of the fish. There's a fair number of brown trout up there as well. And a few rainbows, but also some brook trout and cutthroats as well.
Now, what's the accessibility like up there?
It's pretty good.
Hiking?
I mean, yeah, it's for a lot of it. The river kind of flows along the road up toward the pass, there's pullouts as you drive along. There's some picnic areas and things like that that you can. That folks utilize in the summertime, and it's a short season for those fish up there. There's no question about it. It's a lot of it doesn't even unfreeze until I'd say probably April, May, even late April. Independence Pass generally doesn't even open. The road across Independence Pass doesn't open until Memorial Day every year. So
right. That's something to keep in mind for folks from out of state, that it is one of the passes that is closed for the winter.
That's right. So
and for good
you don't
reason.
Want to fish it. I guess you could fish it at certain times if you snowshoed up it or skied up it, but we don't do that very often. And then again, by the time November rolls around, even late October, it's starting to get pretty cold up there, and we don't fish it a whole lot at those times of the year. So it's kind of a short growing season for those fish, and that's part of the reason why they're not very big in stature, I guess.
And any tips you could give on fishing that section?
It's kind of like typical small stream fisheries, whether in Colorado anyway, which I'm most familiar with, as far as being attractor patterns, royal wolves and humpies and that type of a thing. Fish usually are not selective because they don't see large numbers of insects hatching, so they're more opportunistic of taking something that looks like it might be food if it's floating over them, and they've got to respond quickly to make that choice and take it. So, again, not very large fish, but beautiful little fish and a lot of fun to do if you kind of want to get away from some of the crowds that we sometimes see on the Roaring Fork and the Frying Pan.
Right. Yeah, good show in our archive to listen to on small stream fishing would probably be the one by Tom Rosenbauer that we did with him on fishing small streams. And Tom's with Orvis. I think a lot of people know who Tom is. But
he's one of my favorites.
Did a good show on small stream fishing. And it's interesting that the fish in there are, they're not seeing these hatches go off, and it's actually pretty easy fishing in a lot of those streams because they're so opportunistic. And like you say, get away from the crowds, be by yourself. Probably a good place for one of the Tenkara rods, too.
Exactly. It would be.
Good. And maybe, I guess this probably applies to the whole river, but Danny from Little Rock, Arkansas wrote in, he says, what suggestions do you have for someone wanting to wade fish on the fork? It's pretty much wadeable the whole way, isn't it?
It certainly is. And you know, we get asked this question quite a bit, especially during high water, of whether it's weightable or not. And what I generally tell folks is that in most of the season, it's weightable. The fact of it is that when the water is very high, those fish are pretty close to the edges. So if you do weight it, you don't really need to or want to wade out into the river to speak of, because there's no fish out in the middle. They're all right along the edges. So, the lower down in the river during high water maybe has some more back eddies and things like that where you can wade a little bit, but in, for most of the season, around Basalt here, up to Aspen, we can cross it, if we're careful in many different places. So it's wadeable throughout.
Yeah. So let's talk about that next section, Aspen to Basalt, because the river changes character there a little bit and the topography changes, right? So you want to describe that?
Yep, certainly does. A lot of that water is kind of canyony water. It's some of the stretches just below Aspen, which we fish a large section of public water that's about 5.5 miles in length, right below Aspen, is almost all canyon in water, and there's a great trail along its entire length. It's a beautiful stretch of river with the rocks, a lot of red rocks and different colored rocks in the water that are gorgeous, and big, deep plunge pools and nice little riffles, and the fish, and this is, you know, throughout. The fish are certainly larger as you get closer to Glenwood Springs, and smaller as you are up near Aspen, but there's still a considerable number of 16 to 18, 19-inch fish in that stretch just below Aspen. So
that's plenty big.
Yeah, it's plenty big, exactly, and they're very strong. The fish in the Roaring Fork seem to be stronger than they do in, say, some of our other streams around here, just because, being no dam on the river, they have to fight the rigors of runoff and things like that throughout the year, and it's a little bit tougher on them, so it makes them a little bit tougher fish.
Mm-hmm. So what are you getting good hatches in that section?
Right now, and we see all of the major hatches, the PMDs and the drakes and the caddis and the blue wing olives and all of those. But right now, the drakes really haven't reached that, at this time anyway, reached the upper stretches of the river yet. Probably a week or two away from that. But we're seeing some really nice hatches of caddis up there right now. And seeing some small stoneflies hatching as well, which we see throughout the river also. And it can be really good dry fly fishing up there in the evenings right now. And it's small, it's more intimate. Again, you can fish smaller rods. You're not making tremendously long casts. We float it a little bit early on in the season when it has enough water. Right now, the water level, I just checked a little bit ago, is a little below Maroon Creek up in Aspen, is about 350 cubic feet a second, which is fairly small for rafts to go down. I mean, some of the rafting companies are still doing it a little bit, I think, just for the fun type rafting trips, but to fish it, it's getting a little bit small.
Can you ever take a hard boat down that section?
I never have, but I have some guides who have. It's not something that I would suggest. You know, a few of my guides have done it, I think, just to say they've done it, and we rarely take them down there. Most of the time when the water's high enough, we're running 12 to 13 foot rafts down there.
Yeah, just too hard on a hard boat, right?
Hard on a hard boat, and there's some canyon stretches where it drops quite quickly with some hazards in there that make it to where, like I said, I wouldn't want to do it, but I know of people who have.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I noticed there's a tributary there, Snowmass Creek, that comes into there.
Mm-hmm.
Bring that section. And,
yep, that comes in just above the salt here, probably, I don't know, maybe 5 miles or so.
Mm-hmm. And is
Add
that
more volume to it?
Any fishing up that tributary, or is that?
There is in certain areas up there, more so in the high country. Some of the as it where it enters into the Roaring Fork and upstream for a few miles up there is private property. But once you get above that, you can hike in and fish some of the small stream or Snowmass Creek up in its small tributary type of environment.
Yeah, the small stream stuff. Is this section from Aspen to Basalt, is it is that a section you can fish all year round?
Not as much. We will certainly the season is longer than it is from Aspen to Independence Pass by quite a bit. But there's some times in the winter when, especially if we have a cold winter and we've got some lower flows or something like that, when a lot of that water will be iced over.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you just move on downstream to the warmer water, huh?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So you had mentioned that some of that canyon, just tips on fishing this, good canyon fishing, good dry fly fishing this time of year in the canyon. Any other tips about fishing that, or do you fish it any different way than you'd fish lower down the river?
Not necessarily. I mean, we change our tactics a little bit, but, we'll use some of those same tactics throughout the river. Like I said, I like to dry dropper fish it a lot, just simply because there's some a lot of nice little edges that aren't real deep in the river. And that's, if I kind of feel like if the river's a couple, two feet or less in a lot of places, then I can effectively dry dropper fish it. You can, with the way I like to fish, which is with not a super long dropper off of the dry. So, there's some good stone flies up in there, a lot of caddis, and then in a couple of weeks, again, the drakes and the PMDs will be showing up there as well.
They move up there, yeah. So do they move all the way effectively to Aspen then?
They do.
Drakes and PMDs, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then actually, it's funny because the drakes on the Roaring Fork are predominantly, especially in the lower stretches, predominantly an evening hatch, right in the last few hours or hour, sometimes maybe even a half an hour before dark.
Really?
Where oftentimes as it moves on upstream a little bit and it gets up closer to Aspen, we'll see more of them during the day. And when they move up the frying pan, it's almost all during the day. There's a few in the evenings, but the main hatch of it is during the day on the frying pan as well.
That's interesting. So what do you think that has to, does that have to do with the ambient air temperature or the water temperature or what, or a bit of both?
Probably one of the above.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Of course, you're moving higher in altitude, but later in the year. And when is the green jay kind of cut off, throughout the valley?
Well, in the Roaring Fork, the drakes will start to subside, by the middle of August a bit in the upper reaches of it. In the frying pan, we'll see green drakes into October. We used to have a guide that works here in the shop that always made it a point to try to catch a fish on a green drake dry fly on Halloween.
Huh. Wow.
So, they're not as heavy a hatches as you might sometimes see on a river that hatch lasts for 1 or 2 weeks. On those rivers, certainly the numbers of the bugs are much heavier. We see lesser number of bugs hatching, but for a longer period of time.
I see there's this, I'm looking at a map and I see a Rio Grande trail.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to run the length of the river here. Is that a just a footpath, a bike trail?
It's a bike trail.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it's a terrific bike trail that used to run along the corridor of the railroad, and the local transit authority here purchased that railroad property and essentially has built a bike path along its entire length from Glenwood Springs to Aspen, a little over 40 miles, and it's a wonderful trail. If you'd like to enjoy things other than fishing up here, you should come up and ride along that bike path. It's wonderful.
Okay, good. And it looks like it gives you good access to the river in many places.
It can. It can. It can give you good access to the river in places where it may take you quite a hike to get to it.
Yeah, yeah. I know a lot of guys used to take their bikes up Waterton Canyon, you know, down mm-hmm. in Denver, because you couldn't take any cars up there, but that would be a good way to get up river quick and using the bike. So, yeah, cool. Okay, let's talk about basalt to Carbondale then. That's where the frying pan comes in, right?
Exactly.
So putting comes a lot in. More water volume into the Roaring Fork.
It does, and the valley floor starts to open up a little bit more. It's not, it doesn't fall as dramatically as it does from aspen to basalt. And it becomes a bit of a wider stream. The frying pan is a fairly significant size tributary to the Roaring Fork, and the fact that, it can run, in the summers it can run anywhere from, right now we're pretty low, because they're trying to fill the reservoir, but, it's 100 cubic feet a second now, but it, in a normal summer, we might run 250 to 350 cubic feet a second, which is a significant addition to the Roaring Fork River, as well as also keeps it a little bit colder as well, because it's coming out of the base of Rudi Reservoir.
And that, I suppose, makes it floatable from, because you're getting that extra volume in, controlled by the reservoir, right?
It does. It does. It makes it floatable for a certain period of time.
Okay.
We probably won't float that upper stretch much after, in a normal year, much after the end of July.
Okay.
Just because it starts to get low up there as well. We may fish it if there's a heavy thunderstorm that increases maybe some volume of water, but usually, we don't float it much after that period of time.
Would it during the let's say June time frame, is that floatable in a hard boat, or would you?
It is.
Not? It is.
Yep, you can definitely take a hard boat down it right after the runoff subsides a little bit as it starts to clear.
Mm-hmm. And where do you put in it? Like, I noticed there's a fisherman's park. Is that a boat? Is that where you put in?
That's certainly one of them. That's a boat access just above town. We don't use that one, although there's a lot of people that do. There's one just below town called Hooks Bridge, around Hooks Bridge, that we put in a little more often.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At that point.
And then what would the float from there be down to Carbondale, or?
It would.
Go further.
Yeah.
Okay. You'd pull out at Carbondale.
Well, some folks will float it even further. If you, during high water, you can float, you might be able to float that stretch, and the other thing is about 13 miles or so, you might be able to float it in 2 or 3 hours, so you could go down even further than that.
Yeah, yeah, and because you've got pretty good gradient still there and moving pretty fast, right?
Mm-hmm, it is.
Yeah, okay. So let's take, I want to talk more about that section, but let's take a quick break here, and then we'll come back and dig a little bit deeper into what's going on there, okay?
Sounds good.
Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Tim Hang about Colorado's Roaring Fork River. If you'd like to ask Tim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, so aspen to basalt, basalt to Carbondale now. So you said it's, you get into a little bit of agricultural land down in that area, correct?
Yep, sure do.
It's, the river in there is typical freestone river at that point?
Yeah, typical freestone river, really, Roger, throughout. You find bigger runs and bigger pools from Carbondale or from Basalt to Carbondale than you would in that upper stretch of more pockety type of water from Aspen to Basalt. And because of the fact that it rarely has ice on it at any time of the year to speak of. I mean, we may see some slush ice or something like that in the winter time, but it rarely ices over. So we see larger fish, better bug populations as well, and just bigger runs and pools than you would up above.
And, yeah, it gets much bigger. I remember fishing that section, and there's a lot of water that can be going through there, because I remember wading through a section there and having a heck of a time getting back.
That's true. That's true. Again, you know, when we talk about whether the Roaring Fork is wadeable throughout, you know, you better preface it a little bit of wading with caution.
Right. So. Yeah. It was deceiving that day, you know. I said, oh, this doesn't look too bad. And then, of course, coming, you know, getting across one way and coming back another way can be a whole different story. And I remember having to go get a log out of the woods to support myself to get across the river. It was powerful. It's a powerful.
I've done that many times, too. So.
Yeah. Better than swimming.
Yeah.
So, okay, any fishing tips, tactics that you do differently there than you would in other parts of the river?
Well, we'll certainly, you know, go with maybe a little bit bigger rods, leaning more towards 5 weights than you would maybe in some of that water up higher. We'll fish deeper nymph rigs. You know, when we're fishing with an indicator and a couple of nymphs on the end of it, we'll certainly go deeper than you would, again, with a more of the dry drop or sometimes stuff up higher. And and sometimes some bigger bugs as well. You know, you can fish more, a little bit larger stone flies, a little bit larger prince nymphs. And I keep talking about the prince nymphs being such a great fly on this river, and it is. But, you know, you can just generally using bigger flies, a little bit heavier tippets, because of the fact that the fish are bigger and they're going to be stronger to try to land.
Yeah. We got a question in on the internet that I'm not sure is specific to the Roaring Fork, but I'll ask it anyway, and if you don't know, you don't know. Dennis in New Jersey, and I'm not sure he's talking about fishing in New Jersey or on the Roaring Fork, but he says, earlier today I successfully caught some rainbows using 16 and 18 rainbow warrior flies. Are you familiar with those?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Are those fly sizes and patterns readily received on the Roaring Fork?
Certainly are. Again, you know, we talk about different flies at different times of the year being a little bit more prevalent. And you can, whenever we're asked here in the shop, you know, of what flies are working best, you know, I'm always a little cautious to hesitant to say, well, the flies you have there probably aren't going to work, because as we know in fishing anywhere, you can take those flies and they might be the best flies for that day on that stretch of river. But, you know, we usually try to give them what has worked best for us in the present and has worked the most consistently. And,
right.
And so right now, I mean, we're using more, a little bit larger flies. We're using more of the Drakes, Drake nymphs, Drake emergers, and the PMDs, and the, you know, the PMDs are more of a 16 range, and again in the emerger and nymph category.
What is I'm not familiar with the rainbow warrior fly. What is it? Is it a dry fly? Nymph?
It's a nymph.
Okay. And simulating what kind of insect?
It's kind of an attractor pattern, actually.
Okay.
So, yeah, not really.
Yeah, I've never used one. So, or
simulating anything in particular.
Yeah. Okay. We have, and I also got a question from Rye in Glenwood Springs. He asked, why is fishing the Roaring Fork more fun than anybody else? Tim, listen to the beginning of the show, because our Tim here answered that. listen to the recording, but yeah, we already covered that. Okay, so now we're down to Carbondale and ready to go down, float the bottom section. Would you say that that section is generally floated more than anything else?
Yeah, it probably floated more than anything else. I mean, it becomes a fairly significant sized river down there that people of all different crafts have floated at different times of the year, from inner tubes to small rafts to what we call ducky, just inflatables to everything like that, as well as the fishermen floating it. There's quite a significant amount of wading access in that as well. And so there's a fair number of people that will wade it also. But I think that for the most part, if you took the numbers of fishermen that are fishing it, it's probably more floaters than it is waders.
Okay. So you want to now this is a much longer section than the other sections we've talked about.
Well, not really.
No?
Not really. No, I mean, there's about 14 miles of it between Carbondale and Glenwood Springs, and the other stretches we're talking about have been in the range of 12 to 14 miles as well.
Okay.
It seems like it's a longer stretch because it doesn't fall as much in elevation.
Okay.
So, you might, we'll take all day to float that 14 miles of river throughout the season, whereas, from Basalt to Carbondale, it may take us 3 or 4 hours to float it.
Mm-hmm.
Type stuff. And because of the valley widens out a little bit more, you can oftentimes get off the edges of the main current and things like that that you can't do above Carbondale.
Yeah, and it opens up, the topography opens up quite a bit down there with more agricultural and ranch land and so forth, right?
Yep, certainly does. And then you also, you also have the addition of the Crystal River, which, again, adds more volume of water. So again, the river's quite a bit bigger as in the amount of water that it has in it, as well as being wider and just a larger river.
And where do most people put in then? Right at Carbondale there at the.
Exactly. To float that stretch, the easiest put in is right in Carbondale. At the town of Carbondale has recently purchased the boat ramp there. It's just below the 133 bridge, a bridge that goes across to the town. And then there's about halfway down, there's another bridge called West Bank Bridge that we also will either put in or take out at different times of the year to float different stretches of it. So that West Bank Bridge is about halfway between Carbondale and Glenwood Springs, so it's kind of a good way to, whether you want a short float, you can sometimes have a short float. I actually floated that stretch last night myself. It was about 7-8 miles and from Carbondale to West Bank, and it took us, we made it last about 3.5-4 hours, something like that. So.
Okay. And so, yeah, a full day would be down to what, to take out Midland, is that?
Actually, you're down in Glenwood Springs.
Yeah.
It's at Two Rivers Park.
Two Rivers Park, okay.
Aptly named.
Oh, I see that. I'm looking at a map here, but I also see it looks like a takeout at Midland Avenue. I don't know what that is. But you go down to Two Rivers Park. Is that actually on the Colorado then?
That's actually on the Colorado. Just as it enters into the Colorado. There's really not another takeout point on the Roaring Fork after West Bank before you get to that Two Rivers Park.
And is that on the south side of the Colorado or the north side of the Colorado?
Actually, on the north side.
On the north side, okay.
Uh-huh.
And if you were to, is there any possibility to do multi-day float trips using the Roaring Fork and the Colorado if one wanted to do some camping?
Actually not, because, for the most part, it's private property. That you cannot really access to camp.
Yeah, okay. So it's pretty much a day or half day kind of
yeah,
float.
Day or half day, which is plenty, and then you get to come back and enjoy the nice restaurants and the nightlife.
Plenty of places to stay if you're from out of town, right? Glenwood, Carbondale, Aspen. And there is a lot of camping there, and also up, I know I've camped up there on Rudai Reservoir.
There's tent camping, there's tent camping in the park in Carbondale, and there's a lot of high mountain parking in different areas, or, a lot of high country, camping in, whether it be up Frying Pan or the upper Roaring Fork or the upper Crystal or any places like that, there's a lot of camping around.
Right. And as you said, as you get in this lower stretch from Carbondale to Glenwood, fish are getting bigger down there, right?
Yep, certainly are. Again, warmer water throughout the year, throughout the cold parts of the year. Rarely ever, I've never seen, other than maybe a little bit of ice along the banks of it during the coldest of times, but it's always flowing freely. And again, as we said, it has some in the lower parts of it. It has some fish that come up to spawn or just move out of the Colorado River, which is a much larger river, to spend some time in the lower parts of it.
Now, do you find that you run into more browns the further downriver you get?
Probably. Yeah, probably a few more, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, sure do.
And kind of give us a picture, if you're going to do the float there, what a day would be like floating down there. What time do you get started? What are you looking for early in the morning? How does it go downriver time-wise?
Well, again, there's Roger, it's a little bit hard to say because of all of the variables, of what we're using at each season. But most of our floats here in the shop will originate here in the shop around 8 or 8:30 in the morning, and the guys are on the water by 9 or 9:30, and they're floating till around 5 o'clock or so at night. They may be starting off in the morning with streamers at different times of the year, or they may start off nymphing later on when the hatches come off. They may switch over to dry flies, or when the major summer hatches are done of our drakes or PMDs and things like that, then we might just nymph all day long. And it always amazes me because you might see anywhere from on a given day down there in the middle of the summer when there's a lot of folks around that want to fish, is you may see 20 to 30 drift boats down there, and it seems like you don't really see, because of the way the rivers flows, it's a lot of bends in the river and stuff like that, you may not see so many boats until you get out and notice how many trailers there are at the takeout at the very end, waiting to come on out, and at the end of the day, everybody's caught a bunch of fish.
Speaking of that, are there local services for shuttling your car and trailer down?
Yep, there sure are. There's actually a couple. And again, the easiest way when you're here, and the prices vary on which stretches you float and things like that, is to call us at Taylor Creek here, and we could get you that information. Or, as I said, any of the other fly shops could as well. But sure.
Yeah. Good. Any final tips on the lower section? One thing I wanted to ask about when you just said floating, you're usually pulling out five or six. What if a person wants to catch that late evening drake catch? Are people usually down there waiting, or do you do late evening trips?
Both. Okay. Like I said, last night I was on the water until about 10:30.
Was that with a client or with?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and we floated till until it wasn't you couldn't see anymore, and had some nice activity on the drakes for last night. It was a shorter period of time of about half an hour, 45 minutes. Sometimes it may last a couple hours down there, and we'll put on at this time of the year when those drakes are going heavy at maybe 5 o'clock and float till 9 or 10 o'clock at night.
Okay, good.
And there'll be a lot of waiting people too, that they're hitting it down there as well. It's just because it's so much fun and such a huge bug, and gets those fish really excited.
Yeah, something you can do after work, just go get the gray cache. Was it Molly? She's probably
Molly's going to be able to get out there now. Molly, we're toward the end of the show, Molly. If you're still listening, why don't you just call it a show? You can catch the rest of it later. But get out and hit those brakes.
That's right, right. Well, time to wrap things up here, and stick with me here, Tim, because we've got a few things to give away here to folks, and we're going to give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and also that dozen flies, those hot flies for the rowing fork, courtesy of Taylor Creek Fly Shop. So stick with me, folks, here, and we'll give those prizes away here in just a minute. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S, Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties.com. That's family and then T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes here. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for the show by now, it's too late for tonight, but make sure you do so for the next show, so you don't miss out on a chance to win some of the great prizes we have to give away. Okay, so if you are the lucky winner of the drawing, then we will contact you after the show by email and provide you with information and get the information that we need from you to get you your gift. So that's how that happens. So the first thing we're going to do is give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And Federation of Fly Fishers is a great organization to be part of and to support, and they're into a lot of great activities, as we heard earlier. We have a winner for that. He's in Pennsylvania, and it's Patrick Magdanek. I probably destroyed your last name, but you'll know who you are. Patrick, congratulations, and we'll get you that get in contact with you to give you that membership to the Federation. For those of you who didn't win, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and learn more about the Federation of Fly Fishers. And now we'll give away that one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. And if you want to find out about all the publications Amato does, go to amatobooks.com, and you can see all that they have to offer you. And our winner here is also from Pennsylvania. That's odd. Two in one night. Rick Beggs. Rick Beggs, congratulations. You just got that 1 year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So, congratulations. Now, we're going to give away that dozen of those hot flies for the rowing fork, hand selected by yours truly, Tim Heng. And courtesy of Taylor Creek Fly Shop, taylorcreek.com, if you want to look them up. So, Tim, I'm going to ask a couple questions here, and we'll see if we can get somebody to give me a good answer here. Hold on just a second. Let me get ready here. And I'm just going to try one question tonight. I'm going to make it easy. But it might be tricky, and I think I know the right answer, but Tim, you might have to correct me if I don't have this right. But what is the most prevalent hatch that goes on year-round on the Roaring Fork River? The most prevalent hatch, what insect? And let's see if we've got this. The answer I have here is caddis. Is that correct, Tim?
Yeah, the most prevalent insect throughout the year. You bet, probably.
Yeah, I thought I'd trick him up on this. I thought they'd.
Yeah, that was pretty easy, Roger. Come on.
Well, we only mentioned that like once, but we mentioned green drakes like every other sentence. So,
well, that's true, because it's that time of year.
Yeah. So, So Larry Yeans, is that, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, but it's in Albuquerque, New Mexico, provided us with the correct answer. And congratulations, Larry, and we'll, looks like you're close enough to get up there and do some fishing on the Roaring Fork, so you'll have to come up and visit Tim and the guys at Taylor Creek. So, Larry, send me either through that same text box your mailing address and contact information, or you can send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, so that we can get those sent out to you from Taylor Creek. So congratulations, and I hope you enjoy those flies, and I'm sure a lot of them could probably be used down there in New Mexico waters as well. Well, Tim, thanks for taking time with us tonight. I appreciate it. I know this is a busy time of year for you guys over there, but really appreciate you sharing your experiences with us.
No, it's been my pleasure, Roger. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, great. Well, folks, I hope you've found the archives on our website by now. If you haven't, go out there and explore. You'll find links on the bottom of every page, the archive, and on our homepage. We've done over 170 shows over the past 6-7 years, and you'll find a show on just about anything you'd like want to learn about fly fishing. So it's a great resource for learning about fly fishing. Get out there, poke around in the archive, and you can use keywords to search for different things and learn about all kinds of things. So enjoy. Our next broadcast will be on July 17th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'm going to interview Captain David Eden. And our topic for the show will be Fly Fishing the Golden Isles. David is a professional fly fishing guide and knows the Golden Isles. It's his backyard. The Golden Isles stretch along 100 miles of Georgia's coast and are home to some incredible redfish. Imagine being pulled down a low tide flat, fly fishing for redfish. With so many redfish, they bump the bottom of the boat. Join us for another adventure on July 17th. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Taylor Creek Fly Shop, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.